My name is Anne Doyle. I'm 35 years old. This is March 20th, 1907. No. 2006, and we are in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I am interviewing my good friend Charlie Spinning.
My name is Charles Spinning. I'm 65, no, not 65, 64, almost 65. This is March 20th, 2006. We're in Flagstaff, Arizona, and Ann Doyle is a good friend.
So, Charlie, I've met you in Flagstaff working at the Wine Loft. How do you think that other folks in Flagstaff know you or know of you?
Well, I've lived here 30 years now, and I've been in and out of Flagstaff all my life, having been a native Northern Arizonan. And I think they know me mostly from my more than 20 years at the Weatherford Hotel, where I helped out get Charlie's restaurant going and working on the renovation and restoration of the Weatherford Hotel because I was related to the current owners there. So people knew me from playing the piano there at lunchtime for many years.
Was Charlie's named after you?
Or indirectly. We decided that Charlie's looked better on the window than the names of my two brother-in-laws. So it got named for me.
Were you born in Flagstaff?
No. I've lived here 30 years, but I was born in Ganado, which is maybe familiar to some people, not to everybody, but it's up on the Navajo Reservation, about 40 miles south of Canyon de Chelly and 30 miles west of Window Rock, pretty much dead center on the Navajo Reservation, 200 miles northeast of here.
Did they have big winters in Ganado?
We had a lot bigger winters than we do now. Ganado's actually just 500 feet lower in elevation than Flagstaff, 6,500 feet, so we were frequently snowed in the winter.
When did you move to Flagstaff?
I came here in 1976 after teaching 5 years at Window Rock on the reservation and following years in the Navy and the graduate school and college.
So you graduated from high school in Ganado.
Ganado.
And then went to graduate school?
1959, I graduated in Ganado and then went on to college and service in the Navy and then graduate school in Boston, back to the reservation. And then I always knew I'd probably end up in Flagstaff. It's always been one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, when you went back to Window Rock to teach, was that like going home for you?
That was like a homecoming from Boston to Window Rock.
Yeah, I guess, and so.
And I knew it was ironic there. I was teaching children of people that I'd grown up with frequently that I knew at Ganado.
How did you become to be born in Ganado? Were your parents?
That's a long story. My parents, well, we have a tradition of missionary service in my family. My grandparents were both Presbyterian missionaries in Chile, South America. And my father, after he finished medical school, had had some financial assistance through the Presbyterian Church, and he was planning to just go out for 2 years to serve as a medical doctor on the Navajo Reservation in 1937, I believe. And that was his initial intent, but he ended staying there for more than 30 years. So I happened to get born there with my sister and brother.
What were some of the influences that you had there in terms of people and place? What can you tell us?
Well, my idea in this interview was sort of to give an idea of a unique place in Northern Arizona history and in our world in general of many types of people who came together in a unique place. Back in the beginning of the last century, the Ganado was actually founded in 1901 and has a 70-year-old history.
When you say Ganado was founded in 1901, do you mean Ganado as a town? I'm sure that it had a place name before it was Ganado. How did Ganado become that place name?
It's known as a place now as Ganado on maps, but it wasn't always, of course. There was a Navajo name for the place, Locantil, which means the place of the reeds. And there's a very reedy wash that runs by there with many Anasazi ruins on the edges of the wash there. In the 1880s, the famous trader John Hubble came there and established his trading post, which is still there as a national monument. I think that was in the before the turn of the century. And then he invited Catholic missionaries originally to come there, because being a Roman Catholic himself from Albuquerque, he wanted to have some kind of an educational, religious venture there. And that didn't work out as the Catholics went on over to St. Michael's, closer to Window Rock. There were some Presbyterian missionaries, I guess, poking around there at the same time, and he invited them to come in. The name Ganado, some may wonder why there's a Spanish name of a town in the middle of the Navajo Reservation, comes from one of the famous chiefs that were very good friends of Hubble, because all traders in those days had to establish working relationships with the local powers out there. And there were many Navajo chiefs and chieftains that had Spanish names, Barboncito, Manuelito, and muchos ganados, which meant he had many cows or many many herds. And the name Ganado came from the chief Muchos Ganados, who was a good friend of Hubble and who is now buried with the Hubble family.
No kidding.
On a hillside, or hillside across the wash from the present Hubble trading post.
Before it became Ganado, was there another name before that?
Well, they originally wanted to call it Pueblo Colorado, because of the wash that ran by and always had red, muddy water in it.
Mm.
And, of course, that got confused with the city in Colorado, Pueblo Colorado, and the post office didn't approve of that.
So it became many cows.
So then it became many cows. Or cows, anyway.
What other types of people were there in Ganado with your family?
Well, of course, there were the local residents who lived around the Navajos. Then, as now, were very dispersed in their living. They've now congregated more into towns and communities. But at that time, everyone lived in their family units scattered within a 40 to 50-mile radius of that location, and they came into trade with Hubble. And then they gradually became involved with the Presbyterian mission there that grew over the next 30 years into a more of a community.
You mentioned to me once about Mennonites. What's that?
Well, I was focusing, as I was thinking today, about what that place meant to me and what it, why I am the person I am today, perhaps, as having grown up there, been born there and grown up there.
As an
Anglo person or a pale face or a Biligana, as they call us in Navajo. I was there by virtue of birth, accident of birth. And it gave me a very different perspective, I think, on cultural relationships, on attitudes of people who have moved into a newer place and their relationship with people who have been there for generations and centuries, maybe. And it's a bit of a controversy today as to what was accomplished there and how it was done, and whether bringing a new religion and a new way of thinking to people that have their own perspective and their own ways was ultimately what it was intended to be or how it worked out. There were three focuses there. Part of it wasn't all just religion, but there was also the educational component of a full 12-year boarding school there, and then the medical work, which brought my father there. He came there originally to establish a school of nursing, which he did in the late 1930s and which continued to about 1950. And they trained many, many not only Native American nurses, but Spanish American girls that came over from New Mexico. And those people are still, many of them out there working, some of them retired now, but they went through a full medical or a nursing training program there. Hmm. And that was my father's initial impetus in going there. But you asked about other people that,
right,
that came there, because that's one of my focuses today, were the people that influenced me and that who influenced the multitude of students that went there. They served not only Navajo students, but many Hopi, many persons from Laguna that went, the Laguna Pueblo over by Albuquerque, and a smattering of traders' kids, government workers' kids, Park Service kids, who didn't have another place to go to school. And they went through the school program there.
Right.
But this attracted a staff of people from all walks of life. The original impetus there was from a couple who had been missionaries in China. And they came there in the 1920s, I believe 1927. They brought many of their stereotypes of missionarying to non-white populations, which was a factor in the early days there. But they also were determined to make that place a monument to service of people who, in their perception, would benefit from an education, of bringing them into a survival in the world that was surrounding them, as the reservations were established back at that time. And they turned that place into a true oasis, bringing or cultivating financial contributions from churches all over the United States, which were utilized for building very beautiful sandstone structures that are similar to the sandstone buildings on the NAU campus here in Flagstaff, native sandstone, landscaping with lawns, with trees, with, they had greenhouses there, they had a fully functioning farm. It was a self-sufficient place. We had our own power plant. We imported coal over the mountain from mines over by Gallup. And the place was run by the student labor force, because this is the way, they didn't have to pay tuition, but they worked there running the place, really, in the farm.
When you say the place?
The mission compound, which covered approximately 300 acres of land.
When you moved to Ganado, what was there? Was there just the trading post? And
well, when my parents went there, of course, before
right.
I was born, there was two trading posts there, and there was a school, the church that was built the same year I was born, and the hospital where my father worked for over 30 years, and then all the auxiliary buildings for dormitories for the students that went to school there, a commissary, the power plant that made the place run, all the electricity, the steam heating was all produced there locally, the farm. So it was a huge complex. And you asked about the people that went there. They were individuals from all over the United States with various motivations.
Because where I grew up, there were Mennonite farmers, and you mentioned to me Mennonite there, and you speak so many different languages. I wonder how you became to have an ear for different languages, such as, I think you speak fluently Navajo.
Well, I don't know how fluently.
Okay, maybe you could speak some Navajo for us.
I learned a lot of Navajo because we were a bilingual place there for the most part, and our church services were done both in English and Navajo. And then, of course, I grew up with friends who their primary language was Navajo. So I had an ear. I think anybody that grows up with Navajo develops an ear for other language forms. And I've enjoyed learning exotic languages, I think, like Russian and Chinese.
Would you consider music, Russian and Chinese, simple languages, would you consider music another language, and that maybe you developed an ear for music as well?
I think so. And part of the experience of growing up there was that we made our own entertainment. Mm-hmm. We were isolated. We didn't have paved roads out there at all until the early 1960s, late 50s. So we did our own entertainment. My mother and grandmother were both pianists and taught me to play the piano. We had radio. We listened to the New York Sunday broadcast with Toscanini from the NBC Symphony. We had all this coming in through the radio waves.
So the radio.
And we always had good music in our home. So it was kind of a anomaly out there living so far out in isolation, but still having all the culture because of our what our parents wanted and desired for us.
Is that maybe why you think you became to be interested in music and multiculturalism and interest in traveling and that sort of thing?
I think so. I've traveled a lot throughout the world, and I've been able to use my language ability. I think it's an advantage to grow up in a place where you're not just like everybody else and every other kid on the block, where you hear other languages in your ear. You have exposure to different cultural values, to different events going on in people's lives that are important to them. And you sort of unconsciously absorb that as a child, which I value today. But you'd asked about the type of people that came there. The Mennonite farmers I mentioned, because there were a family of Kansas farmers who were conscientious objectors during the period of World War II, and they went there as an alternative to military service. And they became some of the most important people there because they could do everything. They were the kind of people that could farm, they could build things, they could fix things, and they became invaluable as staff there in just keeping the place going and repairing things and building things. And then there were a lot of little old ladies, not always old ladies, some young ladies, both old and young, but some of them we saw through them, and others we worshipped as people, very enlightened people. They came from extremely high levels of education in the East, Eastern universities, many of them. They had excellent academic qualifications, and they weren't necessarily interested in proselytizing or converting, but standing as examples and using their teaching skills. There's one woman that my mother always said was a true saint, and you don't meet many saints in this world. And she was one of the most influential in my musical experience because she was a fine musician herself.
The Mennonite lady?
She wasn't Mennonite. Oh. She was I don't know really her religious background, but she was in the financial field. She ran all the finances of the place. And she played the organ and the piano.
And that's what you play.
And she was one of these saintly people that you just know, you know, she could do no wrong. But there were people like that. There were other teachers. And then later on, we had a very cross-cultural staff. One of my big, important experiences was with a lot of African-American staff that came there because they had gone to Presbyterian schools in the South, places like Tuskegee and Boggs Academy and Berea College in Kentucky, places like that, and they weren't necessarily able to find really meaningful employment in that era, and back in the 50s, 40s, and 50s. And some of my best friends and teachers were African-American people that would, you know, invite all us little kids. We were always welcome to come to their apartments and eat some soul food and really learn something about African-American humor and another lifestyle that was just sort of interpolated on top of this other cross-cultural American Indian, Caucasian, Afro-American, and there were Asians that came there as well. Most of them through their Presbyterian church connections of schooling and having been brought up places such as the Cameron House in San Francisco that was for in Chinatown in San Francisco, and it was the same type of school. There were schools over in New Mexico for Spanish American population, and these people all just sort of mixed together in this place out there in Ganado.
That's amazing. In Ganado, all these different folks meeting and sharing. Did you live in California for a little while?
No, my parents grew up in Southern California.
Oh, okay.
And then my father went to medical school in the University of California, and they were in Berkeley. My mother taught in a very exclusive girls' school in Berkeley. And then they went out to the reservation, which was somewhat of a culture shock. But they brought their liberal leanings and their cultural inclinations with them. And that's what influenced me as a child.
I guess I was thinking about this process of thinking about what to talk about with StoryCorps, and I was wondering what other things you've thought about in this process, because it seems like StoryCorps itself makes a person think about what they want to share or where they've been or what they feel is interesting maybe or important or topical and timely perhaps. But also I think that what you know is so interesting to me in terms of all the music and the culture and the fact you play the organ and piano and speak all these different languages, like you're a little walking knowledge base and experience to me. So I think it's anything you say is interesting, but
I think the things that bring people together, regardless of their background or their cultural heritage or their economic situation in life, where they grew up, what region of the country, is always through, to me, two things: music and language. And the fact that you can communicate, obviously, through language, if you can speak somebody's language, not necessarily fluently. And I work here in Flagstaff in an agency where I'm able to use a lot of my Navajo, because we have a clientele, Navajo-speaking clientele. And then my travels in Asia. I was in Taiwan in the Navy. I've traveled in China. And I just sort of am able to throw out little bits of this language or that language, and it just opens whole new worlds to people, and they have a new relation with you, a new respect for who you are. And then, of course, it's a given that we can always communicate through music, even if we don't speak the same language. So those two areas of my upbringing and things that were most important to me that I value the most, as I look back on that whole concept of a mission or a proselytizing organization, I see it very differently now. And at that time, I probably didn't think about it as a child, but we have reunions out there periodically with all the people I grew up with and people that went to school there. And we talk a lot about this, what it meant, why was it there, did it achieve its goals?
The mission.
The mission itself, the school. And there are countless examples of people who weren't necessarily happy there because of what they were doing or why they were there, but they still value their educational foundation, and they've prospered and done very well for themselves in life subsequently. Many of them are in tribal government in positions of school administration out there on the reservation. They've been legislators that graduated there. There was a wonderful art teacher there named Jenny Lind, who was a sweet little lady, Swedish lady, who was the ultimate inspiration for R.C. Gorman, the great Navajo artist who just recently died. And there are examples like that of staff who made a difference for people that were there, and they now go back and reminisce about this person, that person, who made a huge difference in their life, as they did for me. Not only the Mennonite farmers, but
no.
And the saints and the less saintly. All types of people.
There are lots of influences in your life here in Flagstaff, too, that you've met. The, remember you telling me a story about, who was it, the Queen of Russia or something?
Queen Lily Ocalani, who lived in the Weatherford Hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Weatherford was just another microcosm of unusual people.
Yeah.
If you can call them that. And there was a rather schizophrenic little lady that lived there for years and years who said she was the daughter of the Queen of Egypt and the King of France, or the other way around.
Very complicated.
Yeah, it was very complex. But people like that I've always gravitated toward because they're fascinating, and if you're responsive to who they are, you always learn something from them.
Do you think that rings true with most of us human types? You know, the more that we're able to listen or be responsive to, we learn something.
Oh, definitely. We have to be open. They had this concert with the Flagstaff Symphony last week of cross-cultural influences of Native American music and modern dance and symphonic music, and it's the same. I think what the creators of that were attempting to do was the same impetus of understanding and getting over conflicts and clashes and misunderstandings. And
all through music.
All through music and the arts in general. But
I'm coming up with an idea right now that maybe because you were raised as a minority, I suppose, in Ganado, that allowed you a lifestyle of listening and receiving and appreciating other people's cultures as opposed to imposing one's culture onto even in a space or a room where you just place yourself in a different way.
I'm not a verbal person, so talking into a microphone is less healthy to me than sitting back and observing.
Would you like to speak some Navajo for us?
Absorbing. My Navajo is not too good.
That's okay.
No, I wouldn't be able to think of anything meaningful.
Well, that's okay. It's just such a beautiful language.
Dinet bazad do it's aida.
What was that?
It means I don't understand much Navajo.
Oh, I should learn that one too.
I can teach you the useful terms and how to get along. That's the most exciting thing about knowing a little bit of a lot of languages. If you have the basics, and then I think I have a knack of relating seemingly unrelated things grammatically, and so that you can plug yourself into a totally different language and see the commonalities. Most people just fight another language.
Whereas you can,
they're afraid of it, or they don't. They don't see the links that make languages work, and that work in one language and the same in another one.
I want to ask you about Ganado again, and where did your parents, did they live there the rest of their lives, or what happened with that?
The whole thing took on a very different focus in the late 1960s and 70s because there was a time of a lot of social ferment in this country, and people were donating to other things, other social causes, and where there was a tremendous financial support from major, you know, churches back in the East and the Midwest that really made that place able to continue to function. That was beginning to dry up, and there wasn't the interest in staff people coming there as much as was in the past. So the school closed in the late 1970s. The medical facility is still there, but it's struggling to survive. And the whole community is rather fractionated now and not really knowing what they want to do with that property, because parts of it still belong to the Arizona Synod, Presbyterian Synod. They had long-term leases on that, but ultimately it is part of the reservation, and the the Navajo tribe and the people that live out there ultimately need to decide what the future of the place is.
And where did you...
There are many options, but they're still... It's going round and round right now.
So...
And my parents did not live out their lives there. They went on to a retirement over in Santa Fe.
In Santa Fe.
As most of the staff moved on as they reached retirement age.
When you talk about the reunions in Ganado, who is attending those reunions?
Well, they're graduates all the way from 1931 to the oldest. I think the oldest two graduates are still living, one of whom was an Arizona State Senator, Arthur Hubbard, was one of the first graduates there, all the way up to the late 1970s. I think 1970 was the last class, so there were, and then all the people that went there in between. We just get together and reminisce and talk about ways that we can still have an input into the preservation of the history of the place.
Do you go up to the, when you say reservation, what does that mean? When I say, do you go up to the res?
Well, there's a common term, the cliche of the res, which can mean all kinds
right.
of things.
It's a pretty big place.
Because I have some of my closest friends are Hopi that I see out in Second Mesa and the Hopi Reservation, which is, of course, an island in the middle of the larger Navajo Reservation. Ganado is pretty much central in the whole combined Hopi-Navajo Reservation area of Arizona. So it's a geographical spot
right.
within this massive land area that is now considered the Navajo Reservation. In the 30s, they were still determining those lines. When my parents went out there, there was not such a concept of the reservation. It was a part of Arizona. And then later on, the boundaries and lines were more clearly defined, although some of those go back into the 19th century as well.
This being the first day of spring, it makes me think about seasonal changes and how maybe when you were growing up you were aware because of the landscape that you were living on of seasonal change and space and time. And I wonder how you feel about the seasons now, or if you're as aware now, maybe as you were then, of
Well, it concerns
changes.
Me with the changes now. That seasons are not as predictable, for many reasons that we can all argue about, climate change or whatever, because there were definitely huge seasonal variations when I was growing up there. You see that in the, well, you work in the museum and you've worked with Native American art, what they portray in a lot of their paintings and the landscape, these vast open spaces, the mesas, the valleys, which is
presence.
Very much a part of Ganado, because it's in an extremely beautiful setting of colorful mesas, sandstone, huge open valleys, which is pretty much still that way. And we had very severe winters back then. We had beautiful springs because of the planting that these early missionaries did. We had flowering fruit trees that would signal spring. There were always scents of apple blossoms and plum blossoms, and then the trees would lose all their foliage in the fall, and we'd have that earthy fall smell, and we'd play in leaf piles like kids did in the Midwest, where they had trees that lost their leaves and changed their colors.
Mm.
And we had wonderful summers that never got too hot. We had lawns and trees to play on and climb and make tree houses, and it was sort of like you lived in the Midwest in many ways, because many of the early people that came there were from the Midwest, and their architecture, their plantings, their ways they did things.
They brought it with them.
Brought there with their Midwestern heritage. And that was another interesting mix there, cultural identities.
Yeah.
So seasons were very important.
Do you feel like it's a little crowded in Flagstaff even? Because it's not as vast as a landscape and a horizon.
Well, Well, we still have the sky.
Thank goodness, yeah.
Flagstaff is not beautiful. Necessarily what I always thought, the place I would always want to live, even though I always thought I'd be comfortable here. But with the changes, with the increased population, the traffic, all that stuff, it has definitely changed. But I live out in the county where I still have space and sky, if as long as I can defend that perimeter.
Do you think that your life is what you expected it to be in terms of ending up here in Flagstaff, or has traveling and all of the experiences you've had, was that what you thought your life would be?
I don't know if I ever worried about it too much, but things just sort of evolve. But I'm happy that I live in a relatively peaceful, clean, calm environment relative to a lot of other places. But I'm still close enough where I can go out to my roots, and at any time I can visit people that I grew up with out there, and we can go back to who we were then 40, 50 years ago.
People don't leave the space here, I don't think, so easily.
No, we get too bound up in making a living here. Busy stuff.
That's true.
So I have to make myself step back. And in fact, we're having a reunion out there in June again. I work with some people that live here in Flagstaff who are alumni of the Ganado School. And we're working on that gathering again that we'll have. It's more like a gathering because it's all ages and all people from all the different classes that went there. Not only the Mission High School, but also the nursing school that my father was involved with.
Well, what would your words of wisdom be for us today? I know that you've contributed an awful lot to Flagstaff, and you've contributed a lot to the community as a whole and probably to the world, knowing your work in China or wherever you were with the Navy. So what do you see yourself doing these next couple of years?
Well, I will continue doing musical. The older I get, the more I go into my music talents, because I teach Chinese occasionally, as you know. And I do a lot of music with our local musical theater. Tonight I'm going to go off to Theatricos and help them out because they need a piano player. I'm going to be retiring as I reach 65 in a couple of months, and I plan to do a lot of music that I've always done but still want to do.
Okay.
As long as I can do that.
Maybe play back at Charlie's.
Maybe go back to Charlie's.
Play lunches.
In my old age, play lunches.
Is there anything from your notes that you would like to talk about?
I think I circled there something on my little list of the example.
Okay.
Example of people, you know, not the people that I grew up with there and that I admired and whose legacies live on. They set an example by their own lives. They didn't just, you know, they didn't preach or say, you got to be like me or you got to live this way or do this way. The ones that are still highly respected and revered and remembered from that time. And they live by their example. Even though most of them have passed on now, many of them are elderly or no longer living, they're images of humans, human beings who were examples for a younger generation just by the who they were and the way they lived and their relationship to other people, whether they were Navajo, Hopi, Anglo, whatever. And that has all come back, even though many of them are not here to hear that now. But they live on in our memories as supreme examples of human kindness and service and dignity. And that's my main focus in recalling that time and place, which may be gone forever, but lives on in people's memories and what their values are today.
Right. You have a lot of memories from there.
Well, I could go on for hours on on specific things, but but the memories are kept alive by our associations with the people that we keep in touch with and the friends that we have that we grew up with and who value what they retained from that experience. They weren't shipped away to a BIA school somewhere, had to get on a bus every August and be sent away somewhere. They were kept close to home where their parents could come and visit them.
Right.
And they could go home, even though transportation was difficult out there in those days, and you pretty much stayed where you were. When my earliest memories are of horse-drawn wagons and the Christmases that we had when people would come in from miles around, and we'd have huge vats of mutton stew, and everybody'd come in their wagons and park their horses and sit around and eat mutton stew and sing Christmas songs and get an orange and some candy and a bag of gifts that were provided. That was one of my favorite memories. That was every Christmas.
Mm.
I didn't know if we were out of time.
Well, thank you, Charlie, for leading by example as well.